Okay, great.
All right, good morning. I will call to order the regularly scheduled Board of Supervisors meeting for this Tuesday, January 17th, 2016, and ask if everyone would please join the Board as we honor America with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you and good morning. First item on our agenda, as always, is public comment number one. It's an opportunity for members of the public to address topics on today's agenda. Anybody wishing to do so, come right on up. And seeing no one moving to the microphone, we'll move on to an update on the Stover issue. We've got Rick Martinez and Ray Reynolds from Nevada. I think, Mayor, are you going to come up? Mayor Lathrop is here as well.
I am not going to let the chief
handle that. Outstanding.
And Rick, I'm going to have... John, probably my head up there.
John, thank you so much for being here. Absolutely. Have a seat right here. Yep. So we've got two microphones there, one stick microphone, and the little square thing is also a microphone. Start by introducing yourself.
I'm Ray Reynolds. I live in Nevada, Iowa, a member of Story County. I'm the fire chief of Nevada Public Safety.
John Pieper with DuPont. I lead the development of the Stover supply chain. I live in Polk City, but we office right here in Nevada on the west edge of town.
Before we get started, I'll go ahead and hand you a couple of updates happening. Do you want to hand this to them real quick? So one of the things Director Martinez asked me to do is to stay on top of the Stover issues with lightning strikes and fires. We've been working very diligently, as always. When the rains come, when the snow comes, it's sort of people kind of push it to the back burner, and so my boss has assured the community that we're going to stay on top of this. We've been working with DuPont on this project. So just to give you a quick update on some of our taskings on our to-do list, we're reaching out to NIST, and as it turns out, DuPont's connected with Underwriters Laboratory, and we're trying to schedule a test burn of about 300, anywhere from 30 to 300 bales in their lab. That'll be interesting to see how that goes, because they think they can put them out. But we'll see how that goes, and John will update you a little bit on kind of the research side of it. We've been having discussions with some of our own businesses in the community, air products with the CO2 that's off gas from the plant, the other ethanol plant. We're doing some research on the ability to extinguish fire using dry ice technique and stuff like that. One of the other things, we did complete the after action review. We had DNR and a round table of folks there. Got some really good people at the table, and our goal is to start having these high level discussions about this product. Since our last meeting, the state of Iowa has updated their code to the 2015 International Fire Code, and there is a chapter on there for agricultural storage of combustible products. So Stover would be applicable. Stover sites is applicable under the new code, International Fire Code, but that would be for new sites. And as we kind of talked about, there are no new sites planned. And as the plant opens up, the plan is to keep rotating stock. We reached out to the ISU Engineering Department. We've had an initial roundtable, and probably one of the most effective things that I feel we've done is we have access to some pretty good experts in the field of fire. And we introduced Mitchell Guthrie to DuPont, and I'll let John talk about kind of what he's done, but he's probably the most leading lightning expert in the country. But he did spend some time in our community. And then from a fire department perspective, we're interested in testing some of the extinguishment techniques using different, before we go down a road of committing to like a F500 encapsulating foam, we want to make sure it works. It works for coal fires, it works for underground fires, tires, sawdust, and the folks that sell it are pretty comfortable that it's going to be our fix. But again, that goes back to the testing part of it to make sure before we go down the road of buying a bunch of foam. From our in-house stuff, the fire department recently purchased under the Fire Act Management, or the Fire Management Act, a new tanker chassis. So we hope to take our 34-year-old tanker out of service and increased a tanker from 1,000 to 3,000 gallons. So from our perspective, rolling on a rural fire with about 7,000 gallons of water on the initial attack, we feel is a pretty substantial amount of water to take to a fire. And then lastly, we're working on some partnerships with folks to try and get some funding. We have a trailer that we've acquired through the Iowa DNR, and we're going to convert that to a foam trailer. So once we find the right type of extinguishment method, we'd like to be able to have this trailer that we could put in service that will basically squirt a foam curtain over the any stover. And I talked to Mitchell Guthrie a little bit, and I'm hoping I'm not taking any of what John has to cover, but one of the things that I thought was interesting is this guy knows so much more about lightning than just I was like, how do you do that? So he told me that he's actually quite surprised in the 27 acres of the Feebold site that we didn't have more lightning strikes. He said with probabilities that you can anticipate a lightning strike every 2 years there, lightning fire. And the fire that happened, the lightning strike that happened on that day at the Feebold site was probably in the top 3% of power of lightning strikes. So it was a very violent lightning strike. But one of the things that he was concerned about was that we didn't have a lot of violence at the site. And what I mean by that was you didn't have bales that were thrown about. And the way he said is if a lightning bolt hit that pile that hard, you should have seen bales off to the side. You should have seen a very crater-like effect. And he said the fact that we're not seeing these at our fire scenes is kind of telling us that we need to be looking at other things potentially that may be contributing to this instead of the lightning itself causing these fires. And then and he also indicated that the lightning bolt that hit is 50,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So the 20 minutes that it took from the lightning strike to the time somebody called in, again, doesn't support that a direct strike to the Feebold site was the cause of the fire. So, and I'll let John talk about some of the other things that they're researching with methane and stuff like that. But we're certainly not done. And I think that from our perspective, the fire department, public safety department, is we're trying to bring all the experts to the table. And with a little bit of additions to our equipment, I think we'll at least be able to bring a pretty good attack to the site.
Ray, thank you very much. Before we go to John, let's just take a step backwards. This is a different board than was sitting here when we had this initial conversation. So back in August, when we had the large fire, and then we had one follow-up with it near Zeering, the Emergency Management Commission kind of hosted a group that got together that included first responders. It included five or six people from DuPont.
Yes.
It included several from the Emergency Management Commission, and we talked about how we were going to proceed from here, there. That's how we're ending up here today, because both Rick Martinez of Nevada and then the Emergency Management Commission has committed to stay on top of this thing all the way through. DuPont's been a great partner as we've been working through this, and something that's important to recognize is this is really the front. I mean, Story County is really the epicenter of any of this, because we are the first to really try to store this amount of silver and see these kind of events. Anything you guys would add just in way of background for Marty and Loris?
No, I'd say it is DuPont's intent to be a great partner, a great citizen of where we operate, but we'd also like to minimize the loss of our inventory as well. So we're definitely engaged here.
Well, I think one of the things that we talked about in the radio interview that we did was that people think that, you know, we're just going to let these things burn and DuPont's okay with that. They lost a lot of money on these fires. So, and we certainly were committed to trying to fight these things without draining a water supply for communities.
Yeah, and the clarification on that is that our position is we would rather lose the inventory than risk the loss of life or damage to other properties. That's our whole reason for saying, let's not take undue chances. Let's study this scientifically and find a solution. Should I proceed?
Yeah, please do.
Okay, great. So Ray has a nice outline of where we currently are with Mitchell Guthrie's visit. Mitchell is finishing up his report, and we'll have a copy of that in through the emergency management group as soon as that comes out. But as Ray said, he has indicated that it doesn't appear that we're getting the direct lightning strikes that he would anticipate that we should get, which indicates to him that we aren't a specific attraction to lightning, that the material that we have and the way that we're storing it doesn't specifically attract lightning. We're getting less strikes. But we are getting fires started by what he believes could be secondary strikes or lightning or voltage current traveling from a primary strike. And so we're looking into those possible causes of getting an ignition from a secondary strike, which is a much lesser strike than the high voltage that was there. And one of those, we've engaged ISU on a project to help us measure whether or not there's methane developing in these stacks that could be volatile. They did a proof of work study this fall, and now they'll go out in the spring as we get into warm-up when you have to have heat for the bugs to be active and methane to be created, and we'll go out and actually measure in these stacks what the levels might be of methane. Preliminarily, we didn't see high enough levels to cause ignition in the preliminary test, but that full test is coming. We continue to work with Verizon on a set of cameras for early fire detection that would help us put cameras at the site, infrared cameras that can detect a fire or the temperature of a fire coming up, and might give us a quicker response time to a fire being started. In conjunction with that, we're working with Iowa State University right now, burning some individual bales for other reasons. But we're adding to that then the Verizon camera test to start to understand what these temperatures are that are required to get us to ignition and how quickly that starts to spread and expand, and maybe what our response time is. That then will be expanded as we move into the Oak Ridge and Underwriters Lab tests this spring or early summer, where they will burn a sizable up to 300 bale stack to get us more specific information on how a fire progresses and what the temperatures and spreads are in that. And as well, we'll investigate any agents that we want to test to see whether or not they have an effect. And one of those specifically that we're looking at is this agent that Iowa TARP has brought to us. It's a wetting agent, actually, in this case, which, as opposed to a foam, which my understanding is a foam serves as a blanket to block out oxygen feed to the fire. And it's difficult in these kinds of fires because so much oxygen is contained within the bale itself that it can outlast the foam. Whereas a wetting agent helps the water penetrate in and take away the heat and the oxygen by penetrating the material more effectively. So we're anxious to see how that might come out. And we just continue to work forward on all fronts. We believe from his report he'll support us doing few further tests that let us put some systems in place and start monitoring our sites through lightning stroke data that's available, and start to understand beyond just knowing we had a strike because we have a fire, understand whether we had strikes and didn't have fires as well. So a lot of work going on in this area.
And I think the most common question I get is, why don't we just put lightning rods out there? And one of the things we found is two things. We may be actually attracting more lightning to the site by doing that, and then the coverage of the lightning antenna itself may not support the grid of where the pads are at and stuff. So I think that's important. We've kind of scratched our head on this and said, well, do we want to bring more lightning to these things, or do we want to, at this point, kind of get the research behind it before we start making moves? They do have some protection at the plant, and that's because of the high structures that are around there and stuff like that. But I guess our message today is that we're still committed to solve this.
Sure, yeah, absolutely, and we sure appreciate the update. It just seems to me that what we learned in 2016 with the two fairly major fires is there wasn't any real commonality between the two other than they were both stover fired, right? One was an older stover pile that you could attribute some decay to, and there wasn't a whole lot of high-standing other structures in the area. The other one was a fairly new stover pile that was not as decayed, or you couldn't attribute to much decay.
Right.
And it was right in the middle of all the wind towers out there,
right,
which clearly are high structures. And unless you guys, in digging through it, you found some kind of commonality, that's the part that struck me is, and now what I'm hearing you say is, we don't see any evidence of direct lightning strikes on either of the piles that would lead us to believe that that's what caused the fire. So I almost come out with, first of all, I come out with real appreciation of how much you guys are digging into it, but I come out of this update with as many questions as I did going into it.
It's kind of like us, too. I mean, we know the lightning is involved in the ignition. It's just a matter of side strikes, direct strikes, or is current traveling through lighting something else. But, we'll keep digging.
Please keep us updated.
And I'll leave some copies here for anybody from the public that would like our timeline and our to-do list, just so they're updated on.
Super. Laura Smarty, any questions or thoughts?
You spoke about a home trailer, knowing that you have a limited roof space where you put the trailer.
Well, we currently have it in the fire station. We put it behind the ladder truck. We have enough gap for a smaller, not enough for a vehicle, but the trailer fits back there. It's about $7,000 to put the piping and plumbing in place to have a foam trailer, but currently I'm not aware of a foam trailer in our county, so this would be able to provide access to other sites throughout the county.
I'd like to thank you, all of you, for not just giving this a cursory overlook or coming to conclusions. Thank you for actually digging in and finding out what's happening and what might be the long-term solutions for it. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Marty, give the little square microphone to Shelly so it doesn't beep at me the whole time. Thank you. Next, we have agency reports, Veterans Affairs quarterly report. Brett.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Rick.
Nick, good morning, everybody.
Hi,
Brett.
Good morning.
Good morning, Brett.
How are you doing? Good. Giving a quarterly report with me, I kind of dug in to some numbers from the federal VA. I think I'll just go ahead and show those to you first, and maybe some of the numbers that I tell you here might really be pretty clear. This first slide here is going back to fiscal year 11. Of course, fiscal year 16 numbers. Can everybody see that okay?
Thank you, Shelley.
FY16 numbers will come out this fall. So this is looking back 5 years' worth on what they consider unique patients at the VA. And that what that means is if a veteran has five appointments in 1 month, they get counted once, not five times. So with our efforts of outreach and having our enrollment counselors up here in Ames a couple times a year, we're able to enroll more people, as you can see, in FY15 over the other FYs.
Okay, so it moves from right to left. So FY11 is in orange, moving across to FY15 in red.
Correct. Yep, right to left.
And this represents Story County unique patients?
This is just Story County.
Okay.
And if you look at the numbers, if you can see the numbers there, 976 to 2,467. That's kind of what we're looking at. So those are veterans in a year's time being counted once.
Okay.
Using the VA healthcare system.
Okay.
And so our efforts here in the county, not only the outreach efforts, but day-to-day efforts, asking veterans if they're enrolled in VA health care. And if they've never enrolled, we do that. We enroll them in VA health care. Now, That said, not all veterans are eligible for VA health care, which prior to 2003 they were. So not all veterans are eligible to receive VA health care. There's kind of eight priority groups, and if you fall in priority group eight, then you're not eligible. Normally, that's a income and an asset issue. Kind of to go down the line, if you're a POW, you're in. If you're service connected, you're in. If you served in country in Vietnam, no problems there. And then they look at income, household income, and assets. So that's kind of the short version, but it's a little complicated.
Well, outstanding that our outreach efforts are to some level impacting what is a dramatic increase from FY14. It looks to me like it was fairly steady from FY11 through FY14, and then we saw a dramatic increase between 14 and 15. Yeah. It'll be really interesting to see if 15 is a blip, what we end up in 16, or if we're starting to see a consistent trend. So yeah. Thank you.
Now, the next one I want to go into is, I'll just get out of this one here, is dollars coming in from VA medical care. So these are dollars, and this is kind of an interesting one. When dollars went down when unique patients went up, but from right to left there, you can see the difference in each fiscal year from 5.5 million to 8.4 million from going right to left. And FY14 was a little over 9 million.
And that is medical care provided through the VA system for Story County residents.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Brent, what would you attribute to the drop between 14 and 15?
Well, you know, I looked at that several times, and I don't know that I have an answer for that.
Okay.
I wish I did. I don't know why that unique patients went up and the amount of money spent went down. Going into another one is Voc rehab, vocational rehab. Now, this isn't the GI Bill. This is students that you have a service connected disability, and maybe you can't do your current job because of your disability. So the VA is going to put you in college for the first time, get a 4-year degree. It might be 2 years or 4 years. And so these are service connected veterans that have going back to school. So from right to left, we were at 2.8, and then at FY15 ended up at 3.3. This is slight below FY14. And I did ask Voc Rehab on these stats. And they said they just graduated a lot of people after 14.
So this is the cost to educate veterans.
Yep.
Story County veterans, this is the cost to educate them.
Yep. Not counting the GI Bill. So this isn't counting the students. They get out, use their GI Bill. These are counting, these are service-connected disabled veterans who need either more education or different education to have a job.
$3.3 million for Story County disabled veterans. I need to learn more about those numbers. I want to know.
And that's tuition. That's books, tuition, and a living stipend.
Yeah.
Is where those numbers are coming.
So that doesn't sound so unrealistic when you consider it as a living stipend.
And do you have the ability to have a cohort group? So maybe you have somebody that's starting in the process in 11, maybe we see still represented in 15. I don't know how many.
Yeah.
Because I'd like to see it, but really, I mean, maybe you're watching somebody transition through. as a positive journey that there's no expectation, that's all new. Every year represents new, you might be seeing. Cohort give you the ability to take somebody that's starting with this group and you're still measuring.
Mm-hmm. And just to kind of clarify in my mind, would Volt Rehab also include assistive devices that they might need, special tutors, anything related to their education?
To their job. Let's just say somebody wants to go in and be an auto mechanic. This would include all the tools that they need once they complete their schooling to get started. Photography. All the cameras that they would need, photography equipment that they would need to go into. And then this also, I mean, your basic, say somebody wants to get a business degree or marketing degree or something like that, this would also include a PC or a laptop when you get started. So, pretty good, real good benefit, really, for those that are eligible. I did about 10 of these, and I just picked out 5 to show you. The next one here, I'll just show you under comp and pen, and then I'll show you a total. Okay, so this one here is under, so veterans, surviving spouses would be included on this. So any veteran in the county that is in receipt of compensation for injuries or pension for non-service connected disabilities would become included in this one. So if we look at FY11, it was 7.3 mil, and FY15, 9.6 mil. It's a tad below FY14. Now, these numbers could change for a lot of reasons. One, if a veteran moves out of county, these numbers would, you know, those numbers would be reported in the county that they live in. Of course, with our veterans passing away, their compensation and pensions would stop. And veterans, a lot of times that would reopen a claim, they might be 40% service connected for hearing, want to reopen, and for some reason, standards, the VA standards have changed, or their disability had changed. Those could go down, and it doesn't do that too much, too often, but I have seen it a couple of times. So these numbers, you know, when you look at them, what does it do for us in the commission? It kind of gives us an idea what direction, so some things that we ought to be, direction we need to go and work on. And then the last slide here I'll show you, which is a combined dollar amount for everything. This is VA healthcare. This is all the ones I just showed you combined. So in FY11, we were at 16.3 mil. And FY15, 21.8. Which was down, again, from FY14. I think we're kind of seeing that pretty consistent with those 2 years, with the exception of the unique patients. So, any questions on that or any of the...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I kind of wanted to, and I did 10 of these, and I thought I'd just bring the 5 that I thought might be a little more interesting than the others. So
I actually just have a comment. I'm glad to see Leanne is back and at least saw a couple of these slides. I think that these slides would make a great article for an upcoming Our Story publication. Especially with the graphs, et cetera, just maybe if we finalize our arrangement to go into the all the Gatehouse media publications, which would be, you know, I guess it would be in the Sun.
Okay.
But anyway, just so thank you for preparing those.
Yeah, so Brett, how hard is it to get the raw data did you use to build all these graphs?
I actually have a book with going clear back to 1999 on this. But we'll get this fall, we'll get from the VA. Actually, we pull right off their website. We just go to the VA website and we can pull, and it'll pull off the whole state of Iowa, the whole nation, and then you breaks it down by counties.
Yeah, so I would have real interest in us following what you're suggesting is building something that compares where we have been, where we are, how that looks compared to other similar counties. But getting to the raw data, I think, is going to be important to be able to build that.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you, Brett.
You bet. So looking at county benefits for the last quarter from, you know, October the 1st to December 30th, we only assisted two veterans with rent, totaling $473. However, we've seen, counting those two veterans, we've seen 352 veterans, counting you know, surviving spouses and veterans for county, state, and federal. In the and then I'm going to give you a breakdown of the different war groups. I believe you all have, you have a copy of this, right? Okay. So World War II, 47, Korea veterans, 52, Vietnam veterans, which is our newly retired group, or they haven't been retired too long, 104, Persian Gulf, 35, Cold War or peacetime is 22. OIF, OEF, and OND, and that's Iraq and Afghanistan, 19. Surviving spouses, 73. Enrollments in VA healthcare, 64. And new claims filed was 75. So the data that I just showed you will, you know, eventually those, what we're doing during that quarter, of course, 125 days from start to finish on a claim, so sometimes they take a little while before it actually reflects on the data. And then with the VA being behind about a year, so we're talking almost 2 years now before we may see some of those numbers. Events during the last quarter, of course, we had the Story County Veterans Newsletter that we sent out. We sent 3,074 by U.S. mail, 669 by emails, and we're trying to move some of the mail ones into emails, those that have an email address. We sent some to surviving spouses, the American Legion, VFW, here in the community, and Vietnam Veterans of America. We sent about 100 to those groups. We had 12 over at the Iowa Veterans Home, so we sent each of them one. And we handed out those newsletters at the supermarket and in the office.
Okay. Hey, Brett, do we know how many veterans receiving benefits, total number we have in Story County?
How many number of, okay.
Veterans or surviving spouses there. How many people that receive VA benefits do we have in Story County?
The only data that I have on that is no, we don't have those kind of numbers. It's just a dollar amount. But the only data I have on that is roughly 10% of the population are veterans.
Okay.
I mean, nationwide data, and about 1% of that 10% are receiving benefits.
Okay.
You know, when I've been doing this for about 18 years. There's three areas that I see really big on when veterans apply for benefits. One, when they first get out.
Sure.
The next one is when they retire. And the next one is when they're in the nursing home. Some are in between that, but that's the majority.
Sure.
Of when they're thinking about it. I had a guy come in. He says, hey, I'm going to my very last shift before I retire. I want to think about applying for VA benefits. Well, it's going to take a while, but I'm glad you came in. So a lot of times, like, say, for VA health care, because their health care is going to stop, they're going to retire, that's when they might enroll in VA health care. So you might say a lot of veterans wait till they need it,
maybe. But sure. Seeing a veteran for the, you know, seeing a World War II veteran for the first time in the nursing home because he finally reached the point that he needs some help. It might be when they would apply for a pension. So.
I would think that the federal government would keep track of those. You're saying they just don't automatically send it down to you to let you know how many unduplicated are.
No. The VA, if this answers, the VA is not calling the veterans and saying, we think that we owe you a benefit, you ought to go see Brett and apply for them.
No, I understand that. The question was how many are on or getting some kind of benefit. So
right.
So we could contact the federal VA, though, and they would be able to provide us with numbers?
Yeah, they could provide numbers, but they won't provide names.
Well, I understand.
Okay. Yeah, that would be, yeah. So that's why we do outreach.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have an office that's open. If veterans can find a number or find our website, find our location, we make connection that way.
Mm-hmm.
But we really make a connection when we go out in the community. Let's say when we do the Moose Lodge or we do up in Story City, really make connection there. We just see more people.
Right.
At that time and get them, you know, find out about more people. But every once in a while, you know, the other day I ran into a guy that was a shut-in in Nevada here, and he's housebound. I've never met him before. So he's at a point where he needs help. He didn't not ask him for help before when he didn't need it. Now that he needs help, just when.
No, I understand that.
Yeah, so it's...
I'm like, Rick, I just want to know the count. It scares me if the federal government can't tell us how many people in the county are receiving benefits because then there's something wrong with their numbers-keeping system, okay?
Yeah.
Brett, what else for us in way of update?
Okay, the other event that we did was a Scoop of Soup event, which was held, I think it's been going on for quite a while, several years. It's at Ames City Hall. That was November the 15th, so we had a table up there. Seen about 12 veterans at that event. We hosted the American Legion service officer training. Each Legion has a service officer. I think back before we had a county VA office, these service officers helped veterans with get benefits. And so kind of doing a couple times a year, getting where I can train them to help out with doing enrollment in VA healthcare, some of those kind of things. And then, of course, our annual supermarket, seeing 125 veterans that day. That was November the 18th. Which was at the Moose Lodge from 9 until 5. We were there. And Rick, thanks for coming that day. And
Loris was there too.
And helping us open up. And Loris was there also. And
very impressed.
So you kind of seen what that's all about. And the majority of our veterans to that event come in the morning. So you've seen the large group. Donations were collected at the treasurer's office. During the month of November, and we're delivered December the 9th at the Iowa Veterans Home. And then that was so over, you know, the veterans just really appreciate it. We did another collection in the VA office the month of December, and we delivered that December 21st. Truckload both times.
Outstanding.
Tomorrow is Veterans Day at the Capitol. I've got a 15-passenger van. We'll be leaving Ames in the morning around 7:30. Got about 12 veterans that want to go down there. And you have a copy of legislative data what we're having tomorrow. And the back page will have the, just turn to that. There's four initiatives. The first one there, which is from, you know, talking about the Iowa Veterans Home, support of the Iowa Veterans Home. The Iowa Department of Veterans Affairs Trust Fund, County Allocation Fund, which is a $10,000 that we get annually. So in support of those programs to continue. Number two, is allow Iowa disabled veterans with 50% or greater service-connected disability rating, as certified by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, that the state of Iowa will waive registration and license fee for one personal vehicle. The next one, number three, is to allow an increase of military property tax exemption from $1,852 to $3,700. And what that is where they take off of the value. In 1947, it was $1,852. It hasn't changed since. And back then, the average home in Iowa was $18,520. So if somebody would just had 10%, and, you know, they had a flat fee on there. So, but that hasn't moved. Last year it was proposed at $5,000. And so this year it's proposed at $3,700. So we'll see.
I'd be shocked if the average home in Iowa was only $37,000.
Yeah. And then, you got that information, and the only other thing I have is the commission, we're planning an event in May, Veterans Appreciation Day. Other outreach, get the veterans in, and we can get them linked up with some services.
Outstanding.
That's all I have, unless the board has any questions.
Brett, thank you. Questions for Brett? Comments?
That's pretty thorough. We had a very good time here on our budget session. It was a pretty free-ranging conversation. We did get an update, though, I guess, on to that effect, on the Homebase Iowa signage. I don't know if you've seen that yet or not, but I was surprised to see that we do actually have more out than I would have suspected.
Deb sent out an email this morning on where they're all located at. Yeah.
Okay. I was glad to see that since Story County was so forward-leaning on that one, that somebody got right out of the gate and did it. But then again, I guess I don't drive around as much as I think I do.
Yeah, I haven't seen one yet, but I'll be looking.
I guess
a former FedEx driver, I think you drove around plenty.
Yeah.
Something like that.
I do have one correction on that email. I talked to Darren this morning. There is not signage on I-35. The DOT will not allow that. So I think that was originally included in the list, but there is no signage on I-35.
So those areas that you talked about that's coming into the county, so they'll see signage coming into the county, not leaving the county, just coming in. Right.
Good. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you.
Yes. Next item is consideration of minutes from January 3rd and January 10th.
So moved.
Yes, sir.
Any corrections, additions, or notations? Olson.
No, so an aye.
Chitty.
Aye.
And Sanders, aye. Minutes pass. Personnel actions as listed, board.
So moved.
Second.
Chitty.
Aye.
Olson.
Aye.
Sanders, aye. Personnel actions pass. Consent agenda, board.
I'd like to pull item 3 out of it. Number 3, consideration of commitment of funds for Ronald Dick Jordan Family Life.
Okay. Motion with that notation.
Second.
Oh, no. Yeah, I was going to ask.
I move. I move. With
now.
Second.
All right. Motion and a second. Olson.
Aye.
Chitty.
Aye.
Sanders, aye. So we go to consideration of commitment of funds to guarantee acquisition of the Dick Jordan Family Wildlife Area at, and I would just underscore, a maximum of $24,500.
Actually, I have no problem with the price. It's a sentence near the end that indicates that's what the remainder of those funds will be used for. And I think that may weigh into a discussion we might have later today with conservation callback. And so I'm uncomfortable with that last sentence. I'm afraid that in accepting this in the consent agenda for the 24-5, but we accept the whole memo, that we're automatically then agreeing de facto that the DAPL funds will be used in that fashion before we have the discussion on the conservation board about their capital improvement projects and where one of their capital improvement projects might also come from, maybe the DAPL funds.
Are you with me on that, or did I do a bad job of explaining the problem?
Rick, can you refresh me when we move to put these funds into the general? In what manner did we do that? So we kind of escrowed them off into the general fund.
That 1.6 is in the general fund, but then the previous board passed a resolution indicating that those funds should be reserved for the Conservation Board to utilize in a manner consistent, consistent with their long-term goals and in terms of leveraging. So talk me through again, Laura, because you lost me. Your concern with the last sentence is what? As I understand, what they're asking for here is, in order to secure the other grants, so this is an $870,000
right,
project.
Right, they need $24,000 from us, $24,500.
Possibly up to $24,000, but they don't think they're not going to, their intent is to not utilize that $24,000. They just have to be able to commit that they can get all the way there with the $24,000.
Right.
If they don't get there, clearly we would use the $24,000.
Correct.
What else does this do to us? So that's what I'm missing.
I believe that the last sentence binds us it prematurely, at least until a discussion this afternoon, into basically saying to them that they're going to use those funds to secure acquisition of the property and the Hickory Grove funds. And this afternoon, I want to bring up in the discussion for their callback that there are priorities in funding, and I believe that one of the projects that they want us to just get a loan from the general fund for is they need to make that decision and a priority of funds available for them. I think they need to decide what's most important to them from their DAPL funds. So I think that we're agreeing to where they say their priorities are. They've declared where they want to use the rest of this money, and I'm going to put before them this afternoon is maybe one of their projects is not the priority for the county that they think it is, and that they should spend their DAPL money on it if they think it's a good idea at this time.
Okay.
So, would you
be willing to make a motion to approve the commitment of funds for the Jordan Family Wildlife area, but scratch the last sentence on this memorandum?
I would. I make that motion to approve the up to $24,500 to complete the acquisition, if needed, for the Jordan Family Wildlife Area, but I'd like to make notes or scratch, I don't know if we can scratch his memo, but I'd like to not...
We can approve what we want to approve.
That I approve, and I move to approve the $24,500 and all the way to everything but the last sentence.
So the sentence that we're striking is, however, should the fundraising effort fall short of its goal, the DAPL funds will be spent to secure acquisition of the property and the HSG funds. We have a motion.
For clarity's sake, if they don't get the monies to complete the application, aren't we kind of decapping them on the ability to complete this?
No, I don't think we are. I think what has happened is a sentence has been shoved in here that is not pertinent to wanting the 24-5, and I'm concerned that this sentence is going to come back and bite us on the...
Did you second, Marty?
Who wrote that?
Mike Cox did,
and I'm afraid that it's then going to come back to us and say, but you already approved this. I've covered
yours
for
a
long time.
So, Morris, before Marty seconds, so you're ascribing HSG to Hickory Grove somehow.
That's how it appears in
HSG is Habitat Stamp Grant.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. So what Mike's trying to say here is if in order to secure that Habitat Stamp Grant, we have to guarantee that we're going to reach our fundraising goal. At this point, we're $24,000 short. And so that's all he's referring to here. I don't think that in reality there's anything that goes beyond the Jordan Creek in this memo.
Okay, so what you're saying is if the DAPL funds had been called these DAPL funds, then I would have read it to apply only to the 24-5. I hear what you're saying.
Right.
Okay, and I'm reading it.
Right, but if there's not clarity, let's just strike that last sentence. So we've got a motion. I'll give you one last chance to second it. I second that. Okay, so we've got a motion to approve this. We're just talking about striking the last sentence, which I think doesn't really mean anything. I think that was just his way of trying to underscore what he was asking for in the rest of the body of the letter. I don't think the sentence impacts it one way or another. Further discussion?
None. I would say it's semantics, but if you need additional, if you need a struct for comfort,
yeah.
I don't see where it changes anything. I'm more about getting the state application successful. And the thing is, I think in the spirit of the way we took these funds in and placed them into the general, this meets that threshold. And so they're telling us through this application that if they can get them elsewhere, how we're using this as a secondary source.
I understand. Okay. Yes. So thank you. I have no more discussion now with the clarity and also what HSG refers to here, because we've used it in every other thing we've done with the budget hearings to mean Hickory, to be related, I thought, to Hickory Grove.
I think the commonality is they both start with H, but I'm not sure that
all right,
this clarifies so that everybody understands what we're doing. If in fact we vote for this, is we're committing up to $24,000, which would, if it was needed, come from that $1.6 million payment from Energy Transfer Partners to Story County, hoping that it's not going to be needed, in order to secure a $308,000 grant to help with this project. Okay? Everybody clear?
Everybody's good.
Olson.
Aye.
Chitty.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. It's approved with the amendment taking out the last sentence. So that gets us through our consent agenda. No public hearing items. Additional items. Consideration of Resolution 1770, amending the inter-fund operating transfer. The one and only, Lisa Martin.
Good morning. This resolution is asking for a transfer of $405,322 from the TIF fund to the Urban Renewal Project Fund. The revenues that come in for TIF come in at a different time than when you commit those funds to a project, quite frankly. So this amount, $405,322, was what was approved at the October 6th, 2015 board meeting. But the project, but the TIF revenues don't come in until FY 17. So when we put the 17 budget together, we didn't include this, but all transfers have to be by resolution. So I'm adding these transfers to the Urban Renewal Project.
Right. So these are dollars that were approved to be in the TIF fund, but they have not yet been appropriated to be able to be spent.
Correct.
Questions? I take a motion.
I move that we pass this resolution, 17-70.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Further discussion? Olson.
Aye.
Chitty.
Aye.
Sanders, aye. 1770 passes. Next item is discussion. Thanks, Lisa. Next item is discussion and consideration of distracted driving policy after our 7-day review. Hi, Lisa.
Good morning.
Okay, so the board approved the draft of the distracted driving policy last Tuesday, and it went out to department heads and elected officials for them to comment. On this policy, I received a few grammatical things, which I did change in the policy, and then a couple of the comments. We had a department ask if the radio was prohibited by the language that we have, that they can't wear headphones, earbuds. I clarified that that is not. They can definitely listen to the radio. They can't listen it to it with headphones on through a phone or whatever. So I did clarify that. I also had a department contact about, you know, the use of a cell phone while they're driving, just kind of clarifying what is actually in the policy. It says you cannot use a handheld cell phone, so you cannot drive down the road holding on to your cell phone. If you have Bluetooth capabilities, that statement in there of the policy that says, you know, it has to be minimized for emergency purposes, I believe that's what it says. And if there are long periods of time they're going to talk on the phone, they do need to pull over. So we did clarify that. They wondered if there should be no cell phone use. So that's not how the policy was written, but I would definitely have a discussion with the board today just to see what your thoughts are. So, and those are the only comments that I received on this. I don't know if the board received anything.
Yes.
I received none. Okay.
I suspect the legislature, before they adjourn, might just ask, codify something themselves here. This has been something that's been being brought before them in multiple years, and Governor Brandt did last week. I think addressed it in his speech to the state.
You're talking about the testing?
Yeah, I mean, we're moving in that direction. You know, you all have to do the drive around to do the
pretty apparent when you drive down.
Painfully apparent. Something.
All right, other questions or action?
I would move adoption of our distracted driving policy, and we're going to bring back for a third reading, or
nope. This would be it.
All right, I move adoption of our distracted driving policy.
I second.
I'm disappointed that I'm not going to be able to put on my makeup anymore. While
I literally am disappointed.
Any further discussion? Cheney.
Aye.
Olson.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. The distracted driving policy is now policy. Discussion and consideration of driver's license and insurance coverage verification.
I received a few comments on this, a couple more administrative type questions, you know, as far as the elected officials, do we need their, does their owner driving their own personal vehicle, should their insurance be verified, and how would that happen? I see it as though, you know, the department heads and elected officials are in charge of doing this. They would then send a copy of their insurance card to be placed in their personal files. We do have files for them. Otherwise, it was, you know, how do we track it? I do plan, if the board approves this, maybe drafting up a spreadsheet to give an example of what we would do if we were tracking it, and kind of give examples of that. The other question that we did receive was in regards to the liability coverage amounts that are in the policy. If you're, it's like two-thirds down the page. Those liability amounts have been in our employee handbook. They have been policy since it was updated in 2010. So I did do a little bit of research to figure out, you know, where those numbers come from. There are other counties that have those numbers in their policy. I reached out to our insurance agent just questioned it was a recommendation of ICAP. These levels, 100,000, 300,000 that were put in there in 2010, those were pretty standard levels back then. My understanding is that some agents require you to sign a waiver if they are going to write an insurance policy that covers has limits lower than that. I don't know, for purposes, but they did recommend this. Now they recommend actually like 250 and 500 coverage amounts. So I did want to bring out that those amounts did not change. They have been current policy for 6 or 7 years. They asked, well, what if the employee doesn't have that if they drive their own vehicle? You know, if they go and get different insurance up above, you know, the question was, you know, as far as the extra cost, would the county reimburse? My comment back to them was, you know, if the employee is going to be verified and they don't have this, then we're taking on more risk as the employer allowing them to drive their personal vehicle. We do have coverage on our vehicles, and our preference is that they drive county vehicles if we're going to training. But if they don't, you know, they don't have liability amounts that are stated in our policy, then they would need to drive a county vehicle. So I don't know if you guys have any comments on that, questions. I was hoping to find like a letter from our insurance or liability saying this is kind of what we recommend, but I wasn't able to find
so
that.
So first thing is, we would prefer that people not use their personal vehicles when they're conducting county business, right? I think that's a reasonable preference for the county to have in a lot of different ways, right? We had a similar conversation, different topic, similar conversation of what are we asking our employees to put forward in the conducting what they do for the county. And we have enough county vehicles to be able to accommodate people using our county vehicles. In fact, our problem is not overuse of our county-owned vehicles. It's underuse of our county-owned vehicles. So I think it's completely reasonable that we say to our employees, when you're conducting county business, you will use a county-owned vehicle And if you don't want to, you need to comply with some of the requirements that we put out to limit liability on the county. Eh? We're not eliminating somebody's ability to drive on behalf in doing their county business. We're just limiting whether they're able to take their own vehicle or not.
It's just a risk management measure. That's what we're
saying. Okay, thoughts?
Does this the state of Iowa have threshold minimums on dollars?
They aren't. They're really low.
Okay.
I believe they're like,
these are obviously higher than that.
They are. I think the minimum, I have to pull up the code again. It used to be $15,000, but I think it did go up to $25,000. We have had a situation where we've had a driver with the bare minimum hit a county vehicle. And unfortunately, especially for property, most vehicles, if it's that $25,000, most vehicles cost more than $25,000 nowadays. So, we want to make sure if for some reason if there's something that we have some good limits out there or requirements that they're going to drive their own vehicle. They don't have to get these. We just need to make sure that if they don't have them, that they are driving.
Correct.
They're covered. They're driving one of our vehicles covered under our liability insurance.
Yep. Further discussion or action?
I would, just before we leave this, I'm sorry to announce this under this distracted driving, but, it's going to happen. When you get notification or notifications rendered up that they said their offense has been observed, what process are we going to engage?
Sure. The complaints will come to the board. Especially if it's under the other policy, distracted driving. They witness the county employee on the phone, texting while they're driving. Those complaints will come into the board. Typically, the board will turn it over to, a lot of times, if it's a personnel issue, they'll come and bring it to HR, and we'll involve the county attorney to kind of investigate and see, did we actually have an employee that was driving a county vehicle in that spot at that time? And then we'll work with the department head to see if there's anything that we need to do, what was stated is actually a found in.
Yeah, so I would suggest, Marty, and this leaves it open to how we proceed, and I think the act, if you're driving down I-35, putting on your makeup, reading a book, talking on your cell phone, then that's different to me than you happen to put in earbuds and listen to a podcast or whatever. They're both violations of the policy, but our reaction to that through HR and our department heads and our other elected officials is going to be dramatically different. And I think we've left ourselves the leeway to be able to address each situation based on its merits. Traditional feeling of the board, and I would assume this is going to continue, is that we're here to support our employees. And if we have an employee that violates a policy, generally our first reaction is a reminder, a signed reminder to that employee that this is the policy and we expect you to comply with this policy. And then the second time we get a violation, it escalates to the next step and next step. And I guess in my time, I don't remember one escalating through one policy to the point of termination, but that would be how something like this would work.
And that's the statement, if you look at that statement, the enforcement, the violation of this policy, and it talks about corrective action, that's a standard statement that we do put in all our policies. It kind of gives us, so like Rich said, we can determine what measure needs to be taken, depending on how bad the violation was and how often in the state. If they've already been suspended for it, then it may include termination. And that's why that language says, corrective action up to and including termination. And it kind of follows. We have our corrective action plan is in our handbook, and there are steps involved within that corrective action plan.
And I like the referral to HR and the involvement or investigation of it, because we're talking here about the driver's licenses. Well, we may have an employee who someone thinks is on county business in their own vehicle because they have the afternoon off or something. And so, I think that this allows us to not jump to conclusions, to truly ascertain what is happening.
Right.
And then as our
step. The thing is, everybody, just because the suspicion is it's business hours, the county, the courthouse is open, you're on county business, may not necessarily be the case. So I think we should give the employees the reasonable now that they have the opportunity to address it without just jumping to the penalty phase.
We should give employees all reasonable doubt in every situation.
Fair enough.
Yep.
Well,
okay.
I'm prepared to make a motion.
Okay.
And I would move to adopt the driver's license and insurance coverage verification policy.
I second.
We have motion, second, further discussion.
Done.
Just for clarity, I have actually seen somebody driving down our I-35 reading a book, eating a burger at the same time. I haven't ever seen the whole mission and everything else.
I've seen quite a bit.
Further discussion. Chief.
Aye.
Olson.
Aye.
Sanders, aye. Passes, and it is now policy. Thanks, Alyssa. Next is discussion consideration to add Story County Community Services to the Marco contract pool for managed print solutions. We got the preview of this yesterday in your budget work session.
You did. Good morning. Carla Webb with Community Services. I would like us to look at adding our office to the Marco pool contract. We have two copiers right now, and what we'd be looking to do is to downsize to one copier that can do the work of both. In the quotes that Marco gave us, if we were to go with them, it would be a savings of $362.28 a month is what they're predicting. Currently, we own both of the copiers, so we'd be looking at a service agreement buyout. And we got recent quotes from Premier on what our buyouts would be. For one copier, it'd be $452.56. The second copier, $2,174.18. So for a total of $2,626.74. What we'd be looking to do, Veterans Affairs is planning to continue their contract at this time with Premier, and their agreement is up towards the end of August. So then at that time, Veterans Affairs would look to jump on with us and use the one copier in our office. So then we'd be sharing those.
But even without VA involved, which would be more savings, mm-hmm. we're talking about spending $2,600 up front in order to get $350 a month in savings, right? Which means that over the course of 8 months, we pay back that. Absolutely. And so for me, this is a no-brainer unless you guys have some reason that we shouldn't go down this path.
I have great comfort in trying to get us all on the platform with the provider. I think I'm shocked that when you come to the board, you would have thought that would have been something that had been long in the rear view mirror. It wasn't, but I think it's something that as a county, we only provide savings and efficiencies when we afford to do.
Well, and I'll just underscore that Carla did not originally participate or did not have community services participate in moving because of the worry about this buyout and thinking we just go ahead and get to the end contract. The reality is we're saving money by doing it now rather than going to the end of the contract and then starting.
Right. And part of my concern with that was Marco was initially looking to add that to our monthly amount, which would draw that out over 5 years, and I just couldn't see the feasibility in doing that. So much more interested if we could just pay it out ahead
yep.
of time.
I move that we buy out the Marco contract.
Marco contract?
Oh, I'm sorry. The
Premier.
Premier.
Is it Premier?
Yeah.
And provide as Marco as our solution.
Yes.
Okay.
Provide.
Second. Motion and a second to do exactly what was on our agenda. Further discussion. Olson.
Yes.
Kitty.
Aye.
Sanders, aye. Passes. Thanks.
I have to get the motion thing down, okay?
Next is discussion consideration of an employee recognition breakfast and award ceremony. We've got Noel and Alyssa for this. So start with what Story County has traditionally done.
Sure. I'll give the background, and then when we get to the actual recommendation, I'll take over. Story County has historically had an employee appreciation banquet, ranging anywhere from October to February. The EAC has organized that, the I've always called it the EAC. So, advisory committee, the employee advisory committee. So what they have done in the past is they put together this banquet so that we can recognize all of our employees for their years of service. And that banquet has ranged anywhere from having a hypnotist, to having no entertainment, to having, I mean, it's really been all over the board the last, at least the last 13 or 14 years that I've been here. Most recently, they have scaled it back because of funding issues, but it was always a time where employees could, it was on a Saturday evening, where employees could get together at a site. Used to have it at Hickory Hall over in Ames. And since that closed, they did have it here at Gatherings last January or February, the date. We were notified that the EAC was not going to have a banquet this year. They were going to kind of hold off and maybe do something in June or July. Because of that, I talked with Noelle and she came up with some ideas. I do believe that the awards, we need to do something to recognize our employees for their years of service. We recognize a whole calendar year. That did change a few years ago. We used to go, I believe it was October to September, and they had a banquet in October. It was pretty confusing trying to figure out who was going to, you know, who didn't get recognized last year. So we did make that administrative change a couple years ago so that we were recognizing a calendar year of anniversary dates. So what we're looking at now is the anniversary dates in 2016. So all of those that got their 5, 10, 15, 20, up to 40 years. So that's the historical data on the employee recognition.
And the only thing I would underscore is dwindling participation to the point that we were seeing more and more costs to impact fewer and fewer participating employees. With that leads to the proposal.
So Alyssa and I discussed a few options, keeping in mind the challenge of the dwindling participation in the last couple years. And we did get some input from other counties, talk to them about what they do for employee recognition. One of the counties had talked about an employee recognition breakfast, and we thought that would be a good option. We think maybe we'll have more participation because it will be in partly part of the work day, so they're not using their weekend to participate in a work event. So we talked about potentially hosting this on a Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. Our concerns with a Monday morning is the potential of employees forgetting over the weekend that they have this event. Tuesday, our concern with that is if we have the time from 7:30 to 9:30, if we'll have time to get the room ready for the board meeting in time. So we talked about the best option we felt was maybe doing it the Wednesday prior to the board meeting and hosting it from 7:30 to 9:30 with a short award ceremony for those years of service awards at 9.
What we've always done in the past, we have recognized the employees at a board meeting. It was always that following, typically the Tuesday after the employee recognition banquet, where we would, you know, formally recognize all those employees for their use of service in a formal board meeting setting. Just so, Marty and Loris, for your information, we do budget for this in the countywide budget under our employee recognition line item. We have always paid for the employee's meal. And then, you know, what EAC has kind of, the total cost, you know, the rental of the building and the food, they split that amongst the participants. And then we have picked up the employee cost. And then EAC would have, or the spouses were to pay for their own or whatever the EAC decided they wanted reimbursement for. So there is money budgeted. What you saw on the agenda, the cost to any of this, is less than what I would have built in for that. Now we may have higher participation if we hold it during the workday. You know, there's a lot of unknowns at this point, but we do have funds.
If they did
looking at having breakfast here in the boardroom and then people going back to work. What do you do with people who don't work out of this building? The engineers department, you know, people in the Justice Center, and obviously people who are in Ames. Would they just come over and then go back?
That's what they've done. You know, we've had different things, like it wouldn't be any different than the holiday dinner that we had in November. I guess you weren't here.
I wasn't here.
Yeah. But we have, yeah.
They do.
You know, that's a little bit different because that's during their unpaid lunch. But this would be, you know, this would be during their work hours. If we have employees that are not working during that, so they work the night shift or the afternoon shift, there wouldn't be any compensation to come to the meal or to the recognition breakfast. They would just be able to come. Yeah. We've done it to all employees.
Yep. So, for me, having been through now, I think, six of these and recognizing the success of our holiday lunch and other kinds of staff gatherings we have here, I think you guys went down a great path. I think my initial preference would have been that we do it on a Tuesday morning and just feed right into a board meeting and do the recognition of a formal board meeting. I do see the logistical problems with trying to take a room like this, and we use multiple rooms when we do something like this, but a room like this set up for people sitting down and having breakfast and talking to each other and then transforming it magically into ready for a board meeting could be problematic. So I'm fully supportive of what I'm hearing you recommend of a Wednesday morning, and then we would recognize that group somehow the next Tuesday. As I look at the different options, I'm suggesting that we move ahead with this and we approve option two for up to 150 employees, which would be a cost of $1,500. It looks to me like that was the most eclectic of the possible options in terms of the breakfast that we're offering. And I'm not a great menu planner. It just looked to me to be the simplest, and that's how I got there.
Got it. Okay. I would move that we adopt option two for up to 150 employees with the possibility of adding more should it be
sure.
So popular.
I appreciate it. You did a pretty well-reasoned research and kind of gave the background that brings us to this point, and I would say that.
Further comments before we vote?
Do you want, if there are more than 150 that RSVP, how you want us to handle that? Do you want us to bring it back to the board for consideration, or do you want us to...
No, I heard Morris's motion to be 150 or more.
It includes
the
weekend
and
over. Okay, yeah, perfect.
We left the door open at the...
We'd like all our employees to participate. What, that's 200 and almost 250.
Yeah.
So if we've got to go to that, we find a way to go to that.
Right.
Okay? Further discussion? Olson.
Aye.
Chief. Sanders, aye. Good job. Thank you. Departmental reports, engineer quarterly report. Darren, how are you doing?
Good.
How was yesterday?
Went as well as it could.
Good. We had a couple end up in ditches.
I didn't take pictures of them because they get a little sensitive.
Yeah, no, I'm not asking for...
That's a DOT truck. There.
Okay, good. That's not one of our Story County trucks.
No, that was yesterday. Say we had chained up the Friday before knowing it was going to be bad, so we had chains on all the trucks and the motor graders ready to go. 5 o'clock yesterday morning, everything was just utilized, as you know. Had a few trucks in the ditch. No fault to them.
Absolutely.
Just split in. Especially the trucks that tried to take gravel roads. They were just a nightmare.
So the gravel roads were in our toughest condition.
Correct. And they're still not the best, but we got through almost all of them yesterday with the front scarifiers. They dig in and try to cut into it, try to loosen up some rock to get some traction. It's kind of hard on motor graders. You got to put a lot of force to get down through it, the thicker ice, so they're trying the best they can. You cannot put salt on gravel roads. It will just make the rest of the winter that road will just turn to mush.
Does it anyway, don't do it.
So that's why we don't do that. But we're out scarifying again today. The buses invade anyway, stay on a hard surface, which was appreciated. But
well, and the real beauty is 50 degree weather coming.
Yes. I hope a lot of gravel spill out at least enough to get some rock showing. I don't think it'll get all the way down through, but it'll help the traction anyway. So we did good. No major incidents, thankfully. This morning, we were not out early because temperatures stayed up and things were fine. Between about 7 or 8, we had a mist come through and temperatures dropped a little bit, so it did get a little slick about 7:30, so we headed out again when they got into normal time, which is 7:30. Any questions about the ice event? I'll move on. Maintenance work, to start with that. Our general winter work, which we've been doing, bridge repairs, erosion repairs, brush cutting, and tile repairs. I'll show you some pictures of that later on in the report. Rumble strips, we do a lot of rumble strips out there, but I wanted to point out, Rick, I think you were involved with this one up at E18. I think Story City had some people that wanted them recut. This is the picture. This is west. It's the ones on the east side of the intersection that we're having the difficulty with. This is after they're recut. You can see they're a little thinner where the wheel paths are. That's because the pavement is rutted there, so they can't get much deeper through there. But what's happening on the other end, E18, that stretch used to be a DOT road. It was transferred jurisdiction to us 10 years ago or so. There's something different with that asphalt. We recut those last fall, and within a year, they're completely gone. So it's a really soft asphalt. These will generally last 10 to 15 years. And so we recut the other ones on the other side, too, but I'm anticipating them be gone. And that is rutted more severely on that side. The only other thing you can do with these is do a PC pavement panel and put it right in the middle, but it's so rutted it's going to be hard to put a PC panel because you'd have to form the rut through it, which would be almost impossible to do. So I'm not sure what we're going to do with that other side, but we're thinking of options. We can't do raised because of snow plows. Don't do raised rumble strips in Iowa.
But how far are we from resurfacing?
We're probably a ways out, unfortunately, that would help. There's something with that asphalt the DOT used has also caused that to last a lot longer, but it ruts more. It's softer asphalt, so it'll rut, but it won't crack.
That makes sense.
There's all asphalt, there's a lot of variances that can do different things, but it's lasting longer.
We have a flashing light at this intersection.
We do. Well, that's when we finally took down the flashing light in the middle of the intersections and put them on the stop signs. But just to give you a heads up, we did get them recut, but I don't expect them to last too long. I've never seen that happen before, so it's a unique situation.
Yeah.
Winter overtime, we're pretty average right now. About after this last ice event, probably about half of our budget, which is $50,000 for overtime. Most of our events have fallen on weekends up till now, so that's why it's...
Can we get these events to occur during normal business hours?
Exactly. And salt, this is our salt shed in Nevada. It's our main storage facility, 600 tons on one side, and we usually do 50-50 mix because that's what we actually put on the roads on this side. We had a little salt shortage last winter, so what we did is we filled both the sides with 100% salt, and we're mixing outside. The downside of that is when we get rain, which we don't get a lot of rain in the winter, except this winter, it kind of washes out the calcium chloride we put in the sand to keep the pile from refreezing and stuff. But we're dealing with that with tarps and everything. But this bin is, we're back to the back wall, so it's pretty well empty. So we're down to 600 tons of salt, which we ordered another 300 2 weeks ago, and they said it would be 2.5 weeks, but that's before the ice storm. When these events happen, it's when that the salt shortage comes. So I hope we get that extra 300 tons, then I'd be pretty comfortable.
But we're halfway through winter, roughly, and we've used half the salt that we had. In previous years, we had been planning on, we never bought 100% of the salt we were going to use. We planned on being get replenished. This is the first year we tried to buy 100% of what we normally use up front. Right? So that's just a difference in philosophy. We are short on salt and sand storage, which is something we're trying to address through some of the projects that we have in front of us. So my question would be, you got another 300, 300,000? Or another 300 tons coming?
Yes.
You got another 300 tons coming, but you don't know when it's going to get here. So can we go ahead and move our mixture back into that second bay that you're to the back wall?
We can, but then when the 300 tons of pure salt comes, we have somewhere to put it. So we really don't want to put it in front of the salt or the mix. We're doing okay outside. It's pretty rare to get these rains in the winter, so it's usually not that big of a problem. We'll deal with it.
Okay.
Snow and ice control policy. With the new board members, I just kind of want to review the policy. I don't think there's anything that needs to change at this point, but I just wanted to make you aware of what it is. It's our Chapter 30 of our Code of Ordinances. The main thing here is the 7 p.m. to 5 a.m. That's when we're on pavements. So after 7 p.m. at night, we typically are not out. This is a pretty standard county policy because counties don't do 24 hours service because counties are generally staffed for one shift. If you work till midnight, it's hard to call employees back in at 4 a.m. to come back in at 5. That's why we do that. Where it gets difficult is when you get an ice event after 7 o'clock. Typically, we're kind of off the roads by 5 p.m. when we get a snow event because we've treated all day. When a snow blows in at 4 or 5 in the afternoon, we try to stick around until 7. Some of our union employees don't like that, but that's our policy, and this is kind of a minimum. So I'm not uncomfortable not meeting our minimum policy, so we stay till 7 when the late afternoon storms come in. But when we get an ice event after 7 at night, that's when it becomes difficult. We typically don't get out to go out, and our employees know that. The sheriff can call an emergency, and that happened the past 2 years ago, I believe, due to an ice event. We came out, but it's more difficult for me to get a hold of employees because they don't need to be on call at that point. So just keep that in mind why we're not out after 7. If you think we need a policy change at some point, we can talk about that. And the other thing is policy says we do not work holidays, Saturdays, or Sundays. This is where we actually do go above our policy, and we do work Saturdays and Sundays because we can do those during the day without the hour issue. We just don't work at night, but we get an event on weekends. We still work. The county, or if the board wants to do something different, just let me know.
There's just a cost associated with it.
There's a cost. Work orders for the past year. This is all the work orders we did. This is the new system we have in place. This is our third year of the new system. It maps them all. It's a really convenient system. We did 752 work orders in calendar year 16. These are mostly the calls that come in, and then a work order is made up and then sent out to get done. This doesn't include all the stuff we do internally, but these are the work orders that are written up.
So what's that number look like versus previous years?
Well, this is really only the second year we've had it in place. Last year, I believe it was 500 to 600, but we didn't have as many work orders made up as just because of the policy of making work orders, trying to get everything as a work order. Now we're building into that, so I don't think we're getting more calls. It's just how our policy is for making.
I felt like this is the first year that we're getting a true look, and now we'll be able to use this year as a baseline to compare future years.
And this is what we have left. That's kind of small on the right, but these are the work orders that are not completed. There's 131, but these aren't high priority type of things. Most of the green are ditch cleaning, which typically we've had 2 to 3 years of ditch cleaning for a long time. I think we're kind of putting a dent in that now, but and a lot of shoulder maintenance issues that we just make a list for when we do our shouldering. But that's what we have on our current work order list, so still a lot out there to do. Moving on to construction projects. Last year we did 12 construction projects, so it was a very busy season for us. The only project we didn't have completed at my last report was the Shipley Road culvert, and that is right down just south of the bay there on the Shipley pavement at 2 miles. The point is not working. This is prior to I had always been very uncomfortable with these head walls right at the edge line pavement on a paved road. Liability concern, we tried to put reflectors on them and tried to make it as visible as possible over the years, and it just got to the age where it needed replacement anyway.
How old is that structure?
That is 100 years plus, probably. Whenever you see those head walls that are decorative like that, you're usually talking 100 years ago. That's just a single box, so it was undersized as well, which caused a lot of erosion issues with the high velocities at the outlet. So we replaced it with the current hydraulic standards. And twin box here, that's the finished product. And then a look from the road, nice flat slopes. Much safer. It's kind of hard to see there, but that's, this whole bank is, it's actually drainage district ditch too, so it's all got that gabion stone. It had been protected a number of years ago because of the high velocities, but it didn't help that. It helped that situation as well. Moving on to construction project design. We finished design on Grant Avenue, which is shown here, and the West 190th bridge replacement project. Those will both be in a local letting next month, February 14th. So we'll open those bids at the board meeting here. That's just a quick picture of the final design on Grant Avenue showing the bike path. This is Moose Road, 190th, and this is north to the right. This is the pavement. There's two stretches. You see the bike path separated out here where we have farm fields, but there's two stretches where we have houses close to the road, so we moved the bike path in and put a 6-foot paved shoulder in between. So bike track will come up to this intersection and kind of curve around, then cross in front of the stop bar in front of traffic. You don't want bikes crossing through parked stop cars, and then they'll cross onto the Ames section there.
We're going to take 190th Moose Road to a stop condition.
We are, that's what I'm going to propose to the board, is we move to a four-way stop situation there for safety.
Board, so make sure that we're all clear on what's happening with this bike / pedestrian path. It was our hope and intent that we could get to the east, so east is down on that page, that we could get to the east of the ditch for the entire thing. There's two stretches, as Darren mentioned, where the reality of buildings, of structures, do not allow that to happen. And so I thought Darren came up and his team came up with a great solution, and that is we do, in fact, move it out where it is off the road but not separated by a ditch. There is a, so it's a 10-foot path that we're talking about putting in there, and then this would have the paved road with a 6-foot paved shoulder and then the 10-foot path on the areas that we've got to come out to the road.
On the outside of the paved shoulder is a flat slope curb for drainage to take drainage away, but, and that kind of separates the bike path from the paved shoulders.
Much more separated than what we were able to do on South Dakota headed down the slope, which is basically just an additional lane of the road.
Correct. And the other paving job for next year is 600th Avenue. We've completed the design on that and purchased all the right-of-way. We'll back up quick on Grant. I forgot to mention we are still working through that one right-of-way issue with the land dispute who actually own the property, and we're getting somewhere on that, so I don't think we're going to have an issue of getting that resolved.
Good.
This project is farm-to-market funded, so you did not see that anywhere in our local budget discussion because it's all funneled through the farm-to-market fund, and it doesn't affect our local budget. We did buy the right-of-way with local dollars, so you did see that in last year's budget because we spent that money already.
What's the time frame? This is one of the things that come up for my coffee. When are you going to start this?
This was let through the DOT, so they set the letting date and the working days on it. It, I believe the late start date is the end of August, at the end of July, unless I believe. And then it has 55 working days. And that's just every day they were. It doesn't count weekends. So that's pretty much 3 months that could be closed.
Yeah, so it's going to be in the fall next year before this.
Could start in April. This depends on the contractor. That gives them a window. They can start in April, or that way contractors can bid on multiple jobs and schedule one.
When is that bid? You get better prices. When's DOT sent out?
This is let February 21st, so okay. week after our local meeting.
So we just know it's going to start this year and finish this year.
We'll know more after. We'll know more after
how they work. If you pin them down to work a certain cafeteria that you're going to pay for that.
No, it's just one of those FYIs. It's one of those, it's high traffic area. And it's just like, people like, you know.
Calendar year 2017, that's the answer.
Well, that's how I started it. It's just like, well, you know, that's a big farm traffic area.
Yeah, sure.
And you're paving it for a reason.
I was just going to point out the two bridge replacement projects that we added towards the end of the budgeting session last year. These two here, they didn't get put into the approved budget, but we plan on a local letting in March on both of these. But we don't expect any money to get spent until FY18, so we can still amend and put that in this year if we want. Then we're talking about the double budget situation again.
Yeah, I just don't want to, I don't want a budget to pay for things twice. We pay for it once.
Again, this will be probably a March letting for these two projects. We're currently buying right away for them, and they have been designed. And lastly, the 5-year road construction plan work session is tentatively planned right now for February 21st. We'll have that right after a board meeting. No action will be taken at that, but we will discuss the prioritization of projects. So there will be decisions made, but no formal action. I'll bring it back to a board meeting for formal action and approval later. But this is just to get input.
Just for a point of clarity on 600, the DOT is going to determine when this is started. Not the county.
The contractor will determine when it started within a window that was set by DOT, and that window is any time after the bid is awarded up to, you think it's late July, is probably the late start date. So the contractor will get to determine when they're working.
But this is outside of our control as far as when it actually happens.
Yes.
I will say, I'm just looking at this, when somebody turns their finger right around and says, yes, why didn't you do it, you know, more timely than
no,
it's not our...
To go back and underscore something Darren said just a minute ago, we can always, if we choose as a board to direct Darren to put in a very specific start date and very specific number of work days, we absolutely have the authority to do that before we send this thing out for bid.
Additional cost.
Exactly. Substantial.
I was not going to now building projects and only just the story you were telling, Darren, and I would not. No. Even when this is one thing. Dollars is another.
We had this conversation over the grant 530 to Breton paving because you got school that you work out. So ideal would be that the work would get done while Gilbert was not in session, but the realities of what that would do to the cost make it impractical, or from my view anyway, impractical to add that kind of cost to a project like that.
Okay. Thank you.
But even the DOT project, you can talk to DOT and say, hey, I want to limit it. No, work with you to some extent. So you can, but it'll cost you. I wanted to update you some on the DOT projects, just so you're aware of what's going on out there with the major highways. This is the interstate job that's currently going on I-35 south of Ames. There's the two Skunk River bridges, and they're widening the 6 lanes through that stretch. Zooming in on that a little bit, those are the Skunk bridges that they're replacing. This is where it starts to impact the county. This is 260th, and it turns into 265th. DOT is adding this 4-cell very large box culvert where there was nothing before. So water is going to come down here and go through here and go through a new ditch built on this side. So in order to do that, they're going to have to replace the bridge over the interstate to make it wider to account for that new ditch. So this is happening next construction season, 2017. So this road will be closed for a long time because that's be a long bridge replacement over the interstate. But that is a DOT bridge. They pay for that bridge. But just want to make you aware that we'll have a closure for a long period of time. It does impact a lot of people. That is right here, 260th over I-35. At this point, I don't think we're going to post a detour because there isn't a good detour to post, and we generally don't post gravel roads detours. The next crossing is way down here at 290th to get over the interstate. So you're talking a number of miles, so... We'll put advance warning signs for the closures, or the DOT will, because it's their closure, but there won't be a posted detour. But we're having difficulties. We talked to DOT that they will put one up, and I'm not sure what the detour would actually be.
just to make you aware that will happen. That's to be closed the majority of next year.
Yep.
This is the flyover bridge, the I-35-30 interchange. This is Highway 30 looking towards Nevada. And this, you'll see this bridge over the top of you in the future. That impacts us here. You'll be heading northbound on I-35 here, and you'll take a new ramp off to the right. And then you'll fly over the top of everything, which would be very convenient to get rid of that mess up there. But we currently have a gravel road right here that dead ends, and there was a county resident in here. The DOT bought that house out. That green line is the new DOT right-of-way line. So this county road, essentially, they purchased right-of-way over the top of it. So we're trying to determine if we need to vacate a county road or not, but DOT's opinion is we still have easements where the road used to go through the interstate, and easements are still there, so they figure if they buy a right-of-way over a county road, it just kind of goes away. We don't have to vacate anything, so that is my plan right now. So it'll cut off about right here, be a dead end. It won't impact anybody, but we're glad to get rid of this situation because we had to build a school bus turnaround here to get the school buses turned around, and there's a steep ditch behind it. This is actually open ditch starts here, the drainage district ditch, so we had to get approval for the DOT to move that. The district gave them approval to move a little stretch of that open ditch. But that is what's going on here. They got a couple big borrow pits dug right here for all the dirt to build that. So we're going to close a portion of this so traffic doesn't get intermingled with the construction traffic here. Speaking of road vacations, I want to bring this up. I'll be bringing this to the board at some time. This is North Dayton Avenue. This is the disease lab here in the interstate. There is actually a county road, at least right away. It doesn't look like a road out in the field. But the right away is still there on the north edge of the disease lab. It's hard to tell, but there is a triangle piece of land back here. It used to be for access to that triangle piece of land. That's the only way they could access it legally. The owner has bought all that, so now it's under one ownership, so they're interested in vacating that, which I have no problem with. The issue is the city's annexed to the center line of it, so the city's going to have to vacate the south half. I think this owner wants to take ownership of the whole road, but we can't legally do that. When it gets vacated, half the road goes to this property owner and half goes to the north.
So NDSL and ABC now lies within the city limits of?
Yeah, it has for quite a while.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll be bringing a road vacation at some point to the board to do our half. And then they're going to have to negotiate with the disease lab to purchase the south half, which might be difficult for the federal government. But
we'll just have them go to the Corps of Engineers. They're really easy to work with on acquiring ground.
Okay, just a quick pipeline update. I've talked to our inspectors, and to the best of their knowledge, everything is complete pipeline-wise in Story County. They will come back in the spring to check for erosion issues or tile blowouts or anything. But so far, we haven't had much. It's gone pretty well. I had them check on the pumping station to try to get an update, but they said they had no control over that, and they couldn't give me updates on where that really stands. So I don't
have
that.
There's still work going on at the pumping station.
And just a reminder that the board did vacate the 303rd lane that goes back to the pumping station, so now they can actually put gates out at the end of the road, which would be, I think, safer for everybody set up.
Darren, while the construction or the Dakota Access Pipeline was being constructed through Story County, were there any problems that you became aware of from the engineer or from property owners?
There was just a handful. I mean, you always get some with a project this big. I was surprised at how well it went. The pipeline was very responsive to any complaints that came up. This was one of the major complaints. We had a big rain while they were stripping topsoil, and it looks like a mess right here because there was a low area where water sat, but beyond that, had more slopes to the ground, so the water ran off. They started working out in that area, and the property owner was upset that they were mixing topsoil with subsoil. So we met with them out there and got that resolved the best we could.
In fact, the only complaints that made it to me were working in wet conditions.
Yeah, and there was another one down south at Cambridge that property owner thought some drainage had been blocked off. Immediately the piping went out with airplanes and took aerial photos and tried to find where it was, and that just kind of went away. I think it was a little unsubstantiated.
Yeah, we'll find the problem. If there's drainage problems, right. If drainage issues were cut and not repaired, we're going to find that out this spring, right?
Yeah. Most likely we're showing it by now, so I'm hoping everything went smoothly, but we'll be checking for more. Moving on to bridge inspections, federal government requires we do bridge inspections every 2 years. We do that through a consultant, WHKS out of Ames. We did start out on a bad note. They started in Lincoln Township, and they had 3 issues right away. Those bridges were... The reason why we show 2 bridges so close is because we have 1 bridge on the county road and we actually have a driveway bridge. We have a few of those in the county. I wish we didn't, but the bridge in the right-of-way is a driveway and it's county-owned. That's why there's 2 right on top of each other. But the one that's on the main road has some piling issues I'll show you. This one here is a concrete structure. Another thing I kind of want to point out, the triangles are the ones that are load-posted. Generally, those are the wood-type structures, because when wood decays, you can post them at a lower load limit. Concrete structures generally can't do that. It's pretty much all or nothing. Once it's ready to go, it's ready to go. So you can't just look at postings to get a snapshot of how good our bridges are, because you can already see these 2 have issues, and it wouldn't have been indicated by looking at the posting map. The same with this one. This is a wood bridge. We've already got repaired. I'll show you some pictures of that. That looks more severe than it actually is because these are actually the old structure pilings.
That looks severe.
This should be a good one. It's not. So that was the biggest concern, that one piling there. And this one was starting to decay. We have already went in and fixed that bridge because it lowered the posting way down. And it's such a large structure, it'd be $800,000 to repair. So we try to do as local repairs on these when we can.
Breeze past the figure there. Could you say it again?
What's $800,000 probably for a new bridge here? Okay. It's a 3-span bridge now, and they usually get longer when you put the new standards in place. So we're able to cut out the piles that were non-functioning piles anyway. And we had a big flood up here last year, and I think a farm was cutting down a lot of debris, and that came down and did some extra damage to the pile, which is why you see all the damage to the wood pile. But you usually cut them down to get to good wood, and then what we do is we go in and splice in a new pile on top, make a flush cut, put it on top, and we put mortar grated blades over the splice to get it secure. And then we put CMP around it and pour concrete, put a hole in the deck and get concrete down and fill those up with concrete. So we just got that completed last month. Unfortunately, you can see in this picture, it was frozen solid, so we had to jackhammer out all the ice around it. But we're able to get that fixed fairly quickly, and there was one pile in the other pier that was starting to deteriorate, so while we were out there, we did that one at the same time. We just protected that one. We didn't have to cut anything out of it, but just trying to get some added life out of these bridges.
How many vehicles per day on this bridge?
Oh, boy, that one I couldn't tell you. I would guess maybe 30.
Yeah, and there's your number, right? 800,000, 30 vehicles a day.
Moving on to the next one. That's the one up here next to the driveway bridge I mentioned. Well, actually, that's the concrete one. It's over here. This one I added to the program next year already, and I'll show you why. Being a concrete structure, we already knew, you can see the bottom of these structures that are concrete. When you start seeing the steel, you know it's old, first of all. This is another one that's probably 100 years plus. But what was concerning about it is these cracks, you can tell how fresh they are. You can tell old cracks because they're rougher or smoother. The brand new ones look real fresh. Both abutments had a number of these cracks, and you could actually see a little shifting on the top, which concerned us and the bridge inspector. So we're keeping a close eye. We're inspecting this one every 3 months now, hoping to get it through till we get a new box culvert in the budget in place next year, hopefully. And then the third one is up here. The back wall's actually shifting in on us, and when that happens, it's very hard to repair. So you almost need to go to replacement at that point. And the first two piles here, this one is worthless, and this one has a little capacity left. We think we're going to try to go in and at least splice a new wood pile in there. We aren't going to do the concrete repair because the back wall is bowing in far enough where it'd be too hard to get the concrete in there, and it wouldn't really serve any purpose anyway, but we can at least get a new one in there.
And were any of those three in our program already?
They were not. They were all three surprises. That's why I'm bringing those up, because we do get surprises every 2 years. Let me point out what that map.
When you do these repairs, how much of a working life do you think that gives this bridge?
I would hope to get another maybe 10 years out of that first structure. You just never know. You get a big flood event and debris could come down and wipe out some pilings, you know, next year. You just don't know. But that also helps protect the piling with the type of repair we did on them. So I would hope to get another 10. I don't anticipate putting that one in the program right now, the long triple span one. But the other two, this one up here, fortunately, is on a farm-to-market route. So we can use farm-to-market money to replace that structure. So I'm going to propose to put that in next year using farm-to-market funds. This one over here, unfortunately, is a local road, but you can also see the importance of it. This is the level B. This is Marshall County line. That's level B. The only way to get back there is that road, really. There's a post bridge on this mile already. So it's somewhat important, but I think that one is actually 5 or 10 vehicles a day. That's as low as they go, is 5. But
right, it might, you got two five metrics, right? Raw number of vehicles a day is a huge metric, but what route those vehicles would have to take if you didn't have that bridge is another huge metric. And the problem with that one that we're talking about right now is there's not really a reasonable way without going around Jericho to ask these people to get there without that bridge.
Right. We already had some bad ones up in this. This is posted 10 tons. That first number, if we get that under 17, we can't get the motor grader over it. So right now we turn around and go both directions on that one. So there's just a lot of larger bridges up in that area with this drainage way.
If you were to start in this township alone and do nothing but bridges in this township, start to finish, how many years would that be?
Dollars-wise?
No. I'm talking years. You know, using your... You know, propose. I mean, if you thought everything else was good, then you could go into Lincoln Township, fix everything you see on this map. 20 years would it take?
If we had enough money to do them right away, I mean, we'd probably, you know, have to hire a consultant to help with the design side, but probably 3 to 4 years.
Just for one township.
Well, that's if you don't prioritize, right? If you just say we're going into a township, remember, it's reasonable for us to do 8 to 10 a year without bringing in a lot of external consultants and stuff like that. The second we go beyond that, now you're talking about having to bring in external help to help design everything else because there's not enough time. The problem before for Story County, when we were traditionally averaging about 2 bridges a year, was on the dollar side. Now we're bumping up against the time side where we're starting to put enough dollars in to do the bridges that we can accommodate without going outside. And so that's for a full conversation. When did you say our work session was? The 21st?
Yes.
That's the full conversation coming on February 21st on what our philosophy is going to be.
Thank you.
Fortunately, things got better from there. But this was the second issue that came up. There's some other posted bridges. I wanted to point this one out particularly because this is that bridge, Rick, one of the two we added to FY17 on 590th here.
Yep.
That's the posted one. So we're replacing that one this year, but the one just south of it, they found a problem.
Right.
And that was just a beam. It's a little hard to tell, but it is cracked. Some, like, wood is... This is a knot in the wood, and that's usually where a weak spot happens, and it's right in the wheel path, and it's cracked to be almost useless. So those are harder to deal with because we've got to pretty much take the whole deck off. But we are scheduled to do that maybe this week when things warm up enough. So we're going to try to get that beam replaced, and then this brick will be back to not posted. But
the rest of the structure was in pretty good shape except for the one crossbeam.
So but that road in particular gets a lot of semi-traffic, and those two bridges really get beat hard, which is why this is a longer structure up here, and it actually bounces so much that we can't keep beating the gravel on it. It bounces because of the span length. But
well, wouldn't it be great if we had pavement all the way up 600?
And this is just, I threw in a picture of a local job we did. We got a lot of these where we've got a couple metal pipes and then a concrete box culvert. We've added drainage over time, but then we had a suck hole on the edge of the gravel road here, and we're digging it up right now, but that's why these old structures. We came and dug out the back and patched that, but these small, we have, you know, thousands of these out there as well beyond the bridges, and try to do as much of this work as we can in-house.
That's what's important to remember, right? Bridge doesn't necessarily mean bridge. You got to define what you're talking about. If we talk about every water crossing that we got on one of our roads, we're in the thousands.
Oh, and lastly, we just want to make you aware this issue is going on out there. We've some sort of a marital dispute or something up north by McFarland Park. About every day, for a two-week stretch, we got a new area that were vandalized. So we had to go out and kind of spray them so you couldn't read it. But we're going to the sheriff to try to get that stopped, but we think we know what's going on, but we can't catch them. If you see these out there, all over the pavement. Road maintenance agreements. One that they on a couple. One is with Ames. We have agreements with most of our cities. Nevada, we don't, but we have one with Ames. The unique part about Ames' road maintenance agreement is snow and ice control only. So you see the different color lines. The blues are what Ames maintains, and the orange was what the county maintains. So recent annexations from Ames, they annexed over here. That one's not in agreement yet. We got to get that added in where the county maintains that. But the big one is over here. Ames is going to annex all the way out to the city limits of Nevada. So we're working on them to get that. Probably won't even be in the agreement because Ames will just take it all, and then it won't be a shared road anymore. It'll be strictly Ames control out to the city of Nevada. But I kind of want to point out, too, Nevada, we do not have any formal agreement. They've never legally wanted to do that. It's always made me uncomfortable, so we kind of had some informal things going on, and they've kind of shifted some of their hours they worked, and wasn't comfortable with that liability with the county, so I sent them a letter before this winter started saying, we're just strictly going to go on what's in the city limits, the cities, and what's in the county, got to go strictly by the lines. Especially since I knew this was coming up right now. As soon as Ames annexes this, which they think will take place about April 1st, to be official, we will no longer have to really take Lincoln Way out there at all. We'll technically have a quarter mile here where we'll have half the road. I'm hoping we can work something out with Lincoln Way where they can take care of that. But we won't need to go on Lincoln Way at all after that point, so Nevada's going to have to pay a little bit more attention to Lincoln Way than they probably have in the past.
Did they respond to your letter?
They haven't. Every letter I offer, I was like, let's sit down and talk about it. I would more than be happy to put agreement together. I believe it got to the attorney level the past two attempts, and it just ended there.
Well, we've got a new city manager. It's a shame we didn't have the mayor of Nevada sitting in here this morning. Well, we got a new city manager in Nevada, so I believe that it's going to be time. Let's make sure that this is one of our topics on February 21st, and then maybe look at organizing a meeting between us and Nevada, because I think there's going to be lots of topics to talk about. I think 210th, and you know, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about lots of things with Nevada, and this could be a piece of it.
Darren, if you could go back to the slide. If I understood you correctly, that up there you're saying that Nevada, do we end before, what would that be, 580th right there?
590th.
590th right there?
Yep.
Okay.
Just to be clear, from this point east, Nevada annexed the entire roadway, both sides, all the way into town.
Right.
For some reason, they did this last little addition when they added on to the ethanol plant. They only annexed half the road there. I wish they would have went all the way with both sides. But so that leaves a little half of the road, a quarter mile, that will be county jurisdiction.
Just right in front of the pond.
Yeah.
Just immediately in front of the pond right there, we have the south side of the road, and they have the north side of the road. So you have... The county has the pavements that they did there at the doorstep mailbox of Dumont. We are responsible for.
Technically, half of it's ours.
Or the south half.
You're talking the north-south pavement.
Yeah.
The west half is county, and the east half.
But Ames is going to take that when they.
Yeah, Ames will take that.
Right
now, the stop sign southbound is county responsibility, so we treat it.
Okay.
Salt sanded.
Okay. And so then what about Old Lincoln Way itself? The same situation? Or do we have both sides of Lincoln Way?
That is Lincoln Way we're talking about.
That is Old Lincoln Way.
Yep, yeah. That's Old Lincoln
so
Way.
So from there, where
but
it is right
Old Lincoln Way runs east-west, so there can't be a west side. I'm wondering if we're talking about two different roads here.
I'm talking about 590 on the dead end.
Yeah, just a couple years ago, Nevada came in and paved the north-south stretch
look
here.
Look at Dumont, where there's little red things that bounce around.
Right here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, correct. But as to Lincoln Way, so from DuPont all the way over to Nevada, DuPont's in Nevada, but right. All the way over, Nevada has all of that.
And that's the purple that's up there
correct.
To the right side of the map.
Yeah.
We have that little section. They did not go all the way to the where they annexed.
We only have half of that little section.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay.
We have this, in essence, the south side of Lincoln Way for that little quarter mile right there just west of DuPont.
Which, yeah, that was my question. Thank you.
By law, when they annex, they have to at least go to the center line of the road. But because Lincoln Way is bought by fee, it wasn't an easement, they could take the whole road, and that's how they got by annexing out to the DuPont plant, is because it was bought by fee. Otherwise, you couldn't use the road as your link. If you follow that.
All right, thank you.
And the last little one, you just approved this one last week, I believe, was on your consent agenda. Slater-Sheldahl area is kind of a jurisdictional nightmare. Through Polk County always used to come up through Sheldahl and do this quarter mile. I don't know why, because it was outside of the county, but they maintained that forever. All of a sudden last year, they decided not to do it anymore. So that turned it back over to us because towns under 500 population got turned back to counties with legislation a few years back. So the county has this, and we have a Boone County agreement that we do this mile. Slater came and annexed this side, so that made it Boone County Slater, but yet Story County was involved with maintaining it. The pavement started falling apart up here, and we didn't know who was supposed to fix it, so that's why that came up. Slater and Boone are responsible for the pavement, but because we're already down there, we agreed to do that snow and ice control only for that entire mile. That's kind of why we're involved. That's been done. Slater is now currently annexing this direction, and they're uncomfortable, understandably, with the gravel road maintenance, so we're going to update our agreement with them fairly soon and take over the maintenance of that until they pave it someday.
When we have a section like that, single mile right here, is it cost effective for us? I mean, does it increase our cost significantly?
When we're just talking about snow and ice control, we are down here doing this. This is paved as well, so we are doing this mile already. R-38 comes down, so we're in the area. Boone County doesn't get very close, is why we do that.
All right.
They don't have anything very close to that at all. So
the answer is it costs us more.
It does.
And it's one of those things that in this case, if we don't do it, who's going to?
Okay, moving on to the federal aid swap. This is probably new to you, but it's a big deal. The county engineers, we've been trying to get this done for a long time. Because of the makeup of the legislature, we're almost sure it's going to happen this year. What it is, we have pretty much two pots of federal money. One is the STP dollars, which is the road dollars that come in through the federal government through CERTPA. STP or road dollars, and we have the BR dollars, which is the bridge funding that comes in through CERTPA as well, but they're both federal dollars. What the DOT is saying, they follow the federal process for every project they do, even if they're spending this local tax dollars. They can absorb all of that federal requirements and give us local dollars in exchange for the federal money so we don't have to do all the federal guidelines. That's what's behind all this. The DOT's for it because when we do a federal aid job, the DOT has to kind of piggyback and inspect everything behind us and then come and audit all of our files. It's a lot of staff time for them as well. So they can get out of that. They're all for
600
it.
Is a good example of this one, right?
Well, 600 is foreign market, and past few years they started to get out of farm market business and consider those more local dollars, but up until then they were just like federal dollars for the DOT.
But this would codify what they moved towards with the farm market.
These would be mainly our bridges and those STP. STP dollars we generally use for just straight overlays.
STP is
the surface transportation federal dollars, and that's what CERTPA. Those are those funds that came in on that chart down at the bottom. It didn't flow through our budget, but they came in. STP dollars, BR money, and then some other types of funding that don't flow through our budget. I point out some of the other benefits of this happening. I guess let me state first why this hasn't happened up till now. It's all revolved around one of the other things when we do a federal aid job, there's wage rates that have to be paid to the workers. When you do a federal aid job, Davis-Bacon wages. The contractors and unions felt like if we did this swap, it would change how money is spent throughout the state. I don't know if that really be the case because we're still going to be doing the same job, but that's why they didn't want it to happen. So that kind of put a block to even get discussed with the legislature. Now everything's under Republican control, and I think they can get it done. There's already a bill proposed. All that's going to do is change the code that will say the DOT can give counties local dollars in exchange. It won't say how. So we do not know if it'll be dollar for dollar. All the details have to be worked out, but the code change is all that's going to get changed up front. Because at the very end, you'll see CERTPA could essentially become almost no point to it anymore because we wouldn't have to go down there and essentially fight for the money anymore. It just kind of comes to us. We sub-allocate down CERTPA anyway, so the funding, we don't. Some regions actually compete for the dollars. The whole idea of the region is we go down and pick out projects that impact the region, but it doesn't happen that way because the money is being used just to overlay roads that are already paved. So I don't know how you say that the regional impact anybody. Counties just, there's not enough money to build new bypasses and roads at the county level, so there's not a lot of point to it. So that would eliminate a lot of that. But I put a lot of other things that would help us out. The planning, we have to do archaeology studies now before we can even start planning for a job when we do a federal job. Just speeds up the whole delivery of the project. We'll be spending 100% now on our projects. We're now, they all require a 20% local match. That'll go away. Reduces the DOT oversight, which is why the DOT is in favor of it. This will be a big change for us, and it's been a long time coming, in my opinion. So hopefully this will happen.
So the savings will be realized at the state level, that will be saving the bridge project.
Yeah.
I don't know that I classify this as savings. I classify this as control. So it would give, if this move was made, it doesn't create any new dollars. In fact, it may be less dollars, but I'm not entirely convinced that DOT is going to go down the road of dollar for dollar. What it does is it allows Darren to do
Darren's job the same way, regardless of what county project we're working on and where those dollars are coming from. And so it gives us more freedom and flexibility. It should allow us to respond more rapidly for some projects and not jump through all the hoops. I'm just concerned on the whole dollar-for-dollar concept. If that's what it is, I think it's great. I don't see it as a cost-savings kind of thing. I see it as a control kind of thing.
Just to kind of give you a better idea of the impact of SERPA. SERPA is a little different than most RPAs. There's a number of RPAs throughout the state. A lot of those were originated as COGS, Council of Governments, so they serve other functions for that reason. For some reason, Central Iowa didn't want to do a COG, so it's strictly transportation funding. So if this goes away, that kind of goes away. Other regions will kind of still function for other purposes. But our SERPA staff functions as MPO, Des Moines MPO staff as well. But the same thing's going to happen with cities. I think the DOT's already said if the funding swap happens, it will be for counties and cities. I don't know what's going to happen with the MPOs, Ames and Des Moines, if that'll go away as well. That's all to be worked out. The legislation will just impact the code change, and then all the details will be worked out after that. I don't know what. The only function CERC will have left is there is a small amount of TAP funds for bike paths. So there still could be meetings for that. As far as our VR and SAP dollars, they'll just be allocated to us. Similar to the farm market fund is what we're thinking. That's what that's all about. If you have any questions, let me know. It impacts a lot of our processes.
This is a key year for us to follow what gets into the funnel, how things are moving through the funnel. There are lots and lots of not just secondary roads related, there's lots and lots of different things that could have a major impact on the way we operate this year.
Lastly, I wanted to cover a couple of drainage district issues. One is just south of Colo. We've had a number of issues with repairs. Get this working here. In this area here, we've got a lot of drain tiles coming in. We don't have too many districts that look like that. But right through this stretch where everything ties in, we've got a bad stretch that's been repaired a number of times. It's hard to see here. This is out in the field. We've done a lot of digging in the tiles. And the holes through here, fortunately, it's only about 4 foot deep, which is shallow enough for us to do without too much problem with our own crews. You can see most of the tiles you see out there are the old clays. This is, you can tell it's been repaired when you see metal underground and the big joints are showed up and it's really displaced and the flow line's all off. So we've come down to about 200 feet of this that need replaced and we've already ordered the pipe. This kind of gets into the other discussion I want to have on how far you want us to go with our county crews. Historically, we've kind of had about a $10,000 limit. Once we reach 10, we kind of want to have a public hearing. I think that could be bumped up because all we're talking about is repairs. This has to be done. And if we do it with county crews, you know, we know what the cost is going to be.
What does state law tell us now? $25,000?
That's the code section that I printed out for you. It changed again. I think I highlighted the areas where it does bump it up to $50,000. Let me move on to my next situation here. This is the east of Cambridge, this tile here out in the middle of the field. We have another similar situation. A stretch has been repaired a number of times and it just needs replaced. It's far too deep for us to do it, and it's got some really fine sand, so it's hard to dig a trench. It just collapses in on itself. So this is where we need to bring a contractor in. And we've already talked to Jensen about trying to fit this work in. The difficulty about using contractors is they really don't know what they're getting into to come in, so it's hard to get a bid up front on how much this is going to cost them to do until they start digging and exposing the tile. So it'd be nice to get something where we could work on an hourly basis or something with a contractor in this situation. But in both situations, I just wanted to get this in your something to think about for the next time we meet as the trustees.
Yeah.
on what those limits are to you and what you're comfortable with the county doing or us contracting out. Once you reach 50,000, then you reach where you have to actually hire an engineer to do a report and come back and design a repair. That starts to get costly fast, and that's when we have the hearings.
So that leads me, Darren, I think we need to have a drainage district trustee workshop. Work with Scott to see if we can get that scheduled. We may want to include somebody like Kent Rohde, and what I'd be looking for from that is kind of an overview of what we do in our drainage districts, an overview of what drainage districts we have, what we see on the horizon, the different policies that we're currently using, and anything we might want to adjust, and get through that work session to get a good baseline of common knowledge, and then we can start to make some of these decisions. Okay?
Well, just by using the two examples you give in your office, is like on the first one, you have some comfort on a dollar value for the job or better work.
Yeah.
And on the second one, you weren't.
Right now, the first one, we're looking at the pipe itself is $3,000, probably at least double that for labor. So we should be under 10, I'm hoping. The second one, we really, it's so deep, we don't know what we're even getting into.
It's beyond the scope of what we can do.
Yeah. And the contractor is Jensen. He's comfortable with at least starting it, see what we get into, and we can put a halt to it if we need to, say this is getting out of hand.
Right.
But that's where I'd like to go with that one, just get it started, see what we get into. But, yeah, I don't have any idea what that dollar amount could end up being.
Well, one of the things that the nice bumping up that we have to 50,000 you see is I think you've done this a lot longer than I have, but when you start talking about engineering costs, that's when people start setting up straight receipts. And if you have the ability to have a job fixed and not have an engineer brought to it, we know that through your office that this can be done.
Yeah, so I agree with that with a caveat attached, Marty, and that is to me. The $50,000 is great, but not in a cookie cutter approach because not all drainage districts are created equal. They aren't all the same size. They don't all have the same land valuation within them. And so $50,000 in a huge drainage district where costs are spread out among many and there's lots of property value is different than $50,000 in a really, really small confined drainage district. And so we just need to have that full conversation.
No, it's fine. I'm glad we're bringing this and fleshing it out.
Okay. Yes. I added this in. I know you can't read that, but this is just in general what this is. Once a year, we meet with the DOT and go. We have a really sophisticated crash data system in Iowa, better than most states. They print out a map for us each year of this is just the fatal and injury crashes for the past 10 years. The bars where you have a lot of accidents at one location. And the large bars, if this is Mortensen and Ames, it's not really a county issue. And this is the DOT Highway 30 issues. But we can see where our problem areas are. And the pluses are the fatalities. But we get this map once a year and review problem locations. Kind of bringing this up now because I have one I'm reviewing. I kind of wanted to bring the board into a little bit. Sorry, the quality is not great, but I just had to zoom in on the one they gave me. This is Dayton and E29 at the T intersection here north of the quarry and McFarland Park's up here. This T intersection, apparently the northbound traffic, we're having issues with people running that stop sign. I would have never guessed that to be an issue. Looking at the crash data the past 10 years, we've had two major accidents with people running a stop sign going north and two people heading straight west. So what I've had a request, they want rumble strips, flashing lights. My issue with rumble strips here, this is just the aerial photo, the rumble strips have to go right here and we have two homes right where they would go. And typically rumble strips are put in when you have a long stretch of road where people get complacent driving 3-4 miles and then all of a sudden there's a stop they weren't expecting. That's really not the area that this is. So I'm kind of ruling rumble strips out. But after talking to conservation, I know a lot of their employees use this route to get out there. They've verified that they've seen a lot of people blow that stop sign. I don't know why.
Well, we've got rumble strips on the western approach.
And that had two bad accidents of people blowing in.
Even with the rumble strips.
Even with the rumble strips. So I pointed. I pointed that out to him as well. But for the time being, we've already...